Okay, Tzoraim Tovim, Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome to part two, Lori Novick, of our series on women in Kriyat HaTorah. We look forward to what we're going to learn in a few minutes. Vakasha, Lori.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rav Jay. Thanks to all of you for coming back for part two. Quick, before we get started, I just want to share something with you. So the development of these materials is in conjunction with a website that I run called Derecheha. And as we were writing this series, which I think has been the most challenging series that we put together for the site, this particular chunk of it, which is focused on the nature of the Aliyah, what exactly an Aliyah LaTorah is, and how it works halachically, was one of the most challenging within that most challenging series. And the reason is, on some level, because it's so basic. I've often found, as the more I learn, that it's the things that we're most used to, or that we that are the most fundamental, that are sometimes the hardest to explain. Things that sometimes come up less frequently, tend to conform more clearly to the rules overall. There's something about some of these fundamental rituals which is particularly complicated. So we're going to be entering into today the internecine world of the makings of the Aliyah LaTorah. First, I want to just do a quick recap of what we did last time, finish off a point from last time, and then we're going to dive into it. And by the end of today, the hope is also to talk somewhat about Torah readings in women's tefillah groups as well, which the material about the making of the Aliyah should already give us enough information to be able to analyze from halachic sources. So last time we were talking about the nature of the mitzvah of Kriyat HaTorah. We saw that according to a wide range of halachic authorities, it's a communal mitzvah where it's taking its cues from rituals that happened, both the Torah command of Hakel, of assembling at the end of the Shemitah year, and from the ritual Torah reading that Ezra Sofer performs on the return to Tzion on Rosh Hashanah. And we saw different features of the reading, including different stages, starting from an enactment of Moshe Rabbeinu, which could be even just one individual reading from the Torah, three verses, moving to the enactment of Ezra Sofer, where that's already a minimum of three readers and a minimum total of 10 verses, and onward to the discussion in the Mishnah about how different days have different amounts of aliyot. We talked about what it means for it to be a communal mitzvah. It's a little complicated, right? A communal mitzvah would seem to mean, for example, if an individual misses it, that they wouldn't have to make it up, right? That would be like a classic practical difference between a communal mitzvah and an individual mitzvah. And we also talked about how that's important, perhaps, in understanding how it is that a braita in Masechet Megillah says that minors, that everyone, including minors and women, can count towards the seven who go up to the Torah. And we're going to have to, it doesn't say you go up to the Torah, sorry, can count toward the seven of the Torah readers. And how could that be? Because the sources that we saw last time show pretty clearly that even if we understand the obligation to be communal, men have a certain piece of it, whether they have a piece of it in terms of having to ensure that a minyan for Kriyat HaTorah takes place in their community, whether they have a piece of it in needing to be at least one of the minimum 10 who are paying attention in shul, whether they have a piece in it in needing to hear it when they're in shul, or whether they've been pieced in it as an extension of their obligation in Kriyat HaTorah. So those are all possibilities for men. And women are, generally speaking, with the exception of a viewpoint by Magen Avraham in a particular reading he gives in Masechet Sofrim, women are considered to be exempt. Now, women still fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyat HaTorah when a woman is in shul and is attentively listening to Kriyat HaTorah. She is fulfilling a mitzvah, but a woman's not obligated to be there. If a woman's there, she should try to listen. That's even a simple matter of showing kavod to the Torah. But women are not obligated to be present for Torah reading. Again, it's not crystal clear that all men are either, but women definitely aren't. And women also can't constitute the minyan for Kriyat HaTorah, as we traditionally understand a minyan, as being composed of 10 men. And that means that women aren't obligated. So it's kind of funny that the Braita in Masechet Megillah suggests that women could count towards the seven. How could that be? So what we talked about last time were two different possibilities for what that might mean. One possibility was, well, if it's communal mitzvah, then really maybe the function of the reader is just to make sure that a halachic entity of Torah reading is audible, that is made, is voiced in the community from the scroll. And then that's the whole world, but the real mitzvah is being performed by anyone who's listening. That's one possibility. And on that reading, then it doesn't seem necessarily that it would matter who is reading beyond that they be a cognizant person who could read competently. A second possibility is that perhaps the readings that a woman is permitted to perform are not all of the readings, and the readings that she's permitted to perform, they're not considered to be readings that are discharging an obligation. They're part of the overall enactment of Kriyat HaTorah, but perhaps not every reader that we have is necessary for helping the community fulfill its obligation for Kriyat HaTorah. So with that, I want to look into just one more time. We started, and I want to look at it a little more. Some of the discussion about, well, what readings could a woman do under those circumstances? Now, this discussion also gets connected to the discussion of the minor, though the minor is a little different because we know that the minor is obligated in Talmud Torah, which might be one aspect of connection to the ceremony of Kriyat HaTorah. Okay, so let's look here. I'm going to hope that my share screen works well on the first try. I bet you're hoping along with me. And it did. Look at that, except that I'm on the wrong document. Let's try that again. Sorry. So close. This is what it should be showing. And I'm going to share it. Yeah. Okay. And now I'm going to get it. Going to get what I want, and it's going to show a portion of the screen, which is what I like to do. Okay, here we are. So this is the Ron, and the Ron basically says, yeah, a woman can count, but that doesn't mean that a woman can be all of the readers. A woman can be filling in the readers. Now, he doesn't say here exactly how many that could be. Perush olin lehashlim kamar. He explains this as meaning they count towards filling in the readers. Veloshiyahu kulam ktanim velo nashim. It can't be that all the readers are minors or are women. The Meiri suggests that this might be fulfilled after the first reading. He suggests that there has to be tzarit l'chol kriya kore echad gadol. There has to be one male adult reading the Torah reading for every reading. V'hoyel v'kara echad kfar nishlama takanat Moshe Rabbeinu. Once that one man has read, we've already fulfilled the enactment of Moshe Rabbeinu. V'enkan od kriya elami takanat Ezra, and takanat Ezra from his perspective is a little bit more flexible in terms of who can read, so that the discharging obligations element of reading would perhaps only be for the first reader. But there is another version that says almost the opposite. Hagot Maimoniot, talking here about a bondsman, where a bondsman is often compared to a woman in terms of obligations and mitzvot, insofar as they share an exemption from positive time bound commandments, says that, oh, it's specifically for the seventh aliyah that the bondsman could go up. Duran says something else that's really interesting as well. He reads the Braita that talks about women counting very closely, and it says Hakol Olim Leminyan Shiva. Anyone could count toward the count of seven readers, i.e., maybe that means specifically at a time when there's seven readers, i.e., on Shabbos. Maybe that's not something that could work for a Monday reading or a Thursday reading or Shabbos Mincha reading, and that's how Mishnah Berurah reads it. Mishnah Berurah says Valo Leminyan Shlosha. Yeah. This whole discussion is not even touching on any reading that's anything other than the Shabbos Torah reading with seven readers. Of course, it's not the only opinion. Centuries earlier, the Meiri suggested that no, it's not Davka. It's not specifically the reading of seven on Shabbos. It could be something else. So I wanted you to see this because I wanted you to understand that even if we were to come to the practical halachic conclusion that there's room for women to be reading from the Torah, There would still be a big discussion to be had about what aliyot a woman could have. And that's not even taking into account one other halakhic factor, which is already discussed in the Mishnah, which is that the first aliyah traditionally goes to a Kohen, and the second aliyah goes to a Levi. And when they talk about Kohen and Levi, they mean a male Kohen and a male Levi. So in practice, we're not sure. Even according to that first line in the Baraita that says that women could count, theoretically at least, toward the count of seven readers of the Torah, it's not clear if we're talking about one of the readings could be a woman, or if we're talking about, let's say, four of the readings could be a woman, and we would need the first three that would fill Takanat of Moshe. If we're talking about, like, we could say six, but the Levi would have to be in there, so really could five of the readings be a woman? Would the majority have to be men, and that's what filling in would mean? So in other words, there's something here that's not worked out, and this is one of these tricky situations where, because something has not been practiced, halakha didn't really fully address this question. I mean, we just have a limit of what there is to go on in terms of what this would mean, because it hasn't been practiced. So it's a real question that would have to be addressed, but within the framework, the initial framework that says that a woman could count, that could be for one or the final aliyah, and I shouldn't really say aliyah yet because we're not there, we're about to be there. It could be for the final reading, or it might be for some more. It's certainly not for all seven. The first two are going to be a Kohen and Levi, and it's probably, you know, you can make a good argument that it's three or less. But again, it's just not certain, and it's just not resolved. Okay, what I want to do now is move into the structure of the aliyah. And the first thing we have to talk about with the aliyah is what makes an aliyah, and it's brachot. Right? That's what we think of, at least, as making an aliyah and aliyah. Now, the funny thing is that the concept of aliyah is something that develops. Originally, who's going to make a bracha over Kriyat HaTorah? The reader. If you think about it, when we were talking about Moshe Rabbeinu making an enactment to read the Torah, and Ezra Sofira making an enactment to read the Torah, they're talking about readers. How many people are reading how many verses? They're not talking about this entity that we call the Aliyah. At the same time, Ezra Sofer tells us, and in our account in Sefer Nehemiah, about how Ezra ran his Torah reading, a very important moment is the bracha. Vayvarech Ezra et Hashem ha'elokim ha'gadol. Vayanu kol ha'am amen, amen. And the entire people responded to him, amen and amen. So we see here already that on the one hand, the essential role originally of someone going up to the Torah was reading the Torah. And yet, from the start, integrated into this to some degree is a ritual that involves a bracha. And here's the important part. It's not just a bracha, it's also a response. That response is critical. And it gets back to the point we were making earlier about the mitzvah action, the mitzvah being fulfilled by those in the tzibur when they're listening actively to Kriyat HaTorah. This responding amen can be understood, and this ritual, this call and response, can be understood as a sort of convocation, calling people together. It's calling people together in praise of God. The Talmud Yerushalmi, when it looks at this pasuk, says, "B'may gidlo." What made him big? How was Ezra making God big through his bracha? Why does it say that Ezra blessed HaElokim HaGadol, the great God? Why doesn't it just say that Ezra blessed Elokim, he blessed God? And the answer is, Bivracha Gidlo. The bracha itself is a way of giving greatness to God. So the person before reading is making a bracha to give greatness to God. And we see something parallel or similar in the Talmud Bavli. And then the response of the people is their participation in it. We see this also when it comes to Baruch Hu. Already in the Talmud Yerushalmi, we have Harei Birkat HaTorah, Harei Hu Omer Baruch Hu. Baruch Hu comes along with making a bracha over the Torah. And the Torah, when he discusses this, says, Baruch Hu Et Hashem Am Barach B'Kol Ram, that someone who goes up to the Torah, who reads from the Torah, is supposed to bless God in a loud voice. Kedei she'ya'anu ha'tzibur baruch Hashem ha'mvorach. The reason he's reciting that bracha is in order to get a response. And I think we understand this about Baruch Hu. If you think about it, Baruch Hu is, as it were, it's calling everyone to prayer. We consider it to be what we call a davar shebikdusha, a matter that sanctifies God's name. Now, Baruch Hu, it's kind of funny that we call it davar shebikdusha because the word kadosh isn't anywhere there. Like when we call kedusha a davar shebikdusha, that makes some sense to us. It's all about the sanctity of God. When we call kaddish a davar shebikdusha, that makes sense to us too. Kaddish starts with Yitgadal v'Yitgadash. May God be magnified and sanctified. Baruch Hu is a little funny in that way as a Devar Shebikdusha because it doesn't have the word, the language of sanctification there. But as a process that entails a minyan and a call and response to glorify God, Baruch Hu in particular is considered to be a sacred convocation that sanctifies God. So what we're seeing is that we have this double whammy of the bracha before the Torah is read and of Baruch Hu, both being opportunities to magnify, to glorify God, and being opportunities for the community that wishes to fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah, the obligation or of hearing Kriyas HaTorah, that moment of the community to show that they're actively engaged. Right? You have Baruch Hu before tefillah, and part of what it's doing is a convocation saying, we're all in this tefillah. We're participating. We're here. We're part of what's creating this. We're part of this tzibur that is fulfilling this mitzvah. Similarly, something similar is happening with the Baruch Hu. And even if you think about it, the bracha at the beginning of Kriyas HaTorah, what's it about? Asher bachar banu mikol hamim. It's about our identity as a community, right? It's about our identity as a community. It's a bracha that's about how we're all communally connected to Torah. And we signify that we're a part of that and we're fulfilling hearing the Torah reading by saying, amen. Okay, what about women? So let's say, going back to that braita that suggested a woman could count as a reader of the Torah. Would she have been able to say these brachot? Well, one question that we'd have to resolve first in trying to understand that is if a woman can say Devar Shebikdusha. That's actually not such a simple question to answer. We know that we need a minyan to make a Devar Shebikdusha. Whether once a minyan is present, a woman can say a Devar Shebikdusha is something that gets debated. It's something that comes up in particular in a very practical way in discussions of women reciting Kaddish, right? Because that's a Devar Shebikdusha. We're supposed to say it when a minyan is present. Can a woman say it? So, you know, just to give you a sense, you know, we really have the full spectrum of views. The Meiri, medieval Provence, is saying, and Devar Shebikdusha, Masur L'Nashim. No way. Women do not recite a Devar Shebikdusha. It doesn't matter if a minyan is there, a minyan is not there. A woman is not going to be able to say a Devar Shebikdusha. More recently, 17th century, the Chavos Yaris says, he's talking about Kaddish, but he says, Isha mitzuvah kiddush Hashem. A woman is actually commanded in kiddush Hashem. And he's talking about this in the context of women and the possibility of women reciting Kaddish. I don't want to imply that the Chavos Yair is saying that women can say Kaddish in every situation. That's a separate discussion, okay? But there is this fundamental debate about when a minyan is present. Is there a context in which a woman might be able to say a Devar Shebikdusha? And it's an open question. Funnily enough, the Chatam Sofer suggests that, because he's not, as we know, he's not a great liberal, he's not talking specifically about women here. The Chatam Sofer suggests that the initial enactment of Kriyas HaTorah included Brachot and included Baruch Hu. And not only that, he suggests that every individual reader would recite Baruch Hu from the initial enactment of Kriyas HaTorah. If that's the case, then that might imply that a woman could say Baruch Hu were she a reader of the Torah, because once the Baraita is suggesting that there would be a possibility of a woman acting as a reader, if it were to be assumed that all readers were saying Baruch Hu, maybe the assumption is a woman would have been doing it also. Not necessarily. It might be a stretch. It's hard to say that this is what Chasam Sofer had in mind. It's kind of an intriguing, it's an intriguing thought, and it's not an open and shut discussion. It's not quite as simple as just saying Baruch Hu is involved. Certainly a woman couldn't say it. Baruch Hu is involved. There are many who would say a woman couldn't say it. There's some reason to think there could be that a woman could have said it. But you know what? What's more interesting is really how the brachot work. The brachot are kind of bookends initially. That's more pronounced initially. Now it's less pronounced. We have a bracha before Kriyas Torah, and we have a bracha after Kriyas Torah. In our day, we have a bracha before and after each individual reading. We're going to get to that in a minute. But overall, what does it mean to have a bracha before and a bracha after? Well, the Talmud in Brachot actually learns this from an analogy to food. The bracha min haTorah of Birkat HaMazon is after you eat. So the Talmud in Brachot says, look, if it's fully obligatory with food to make a bracha after you eat, and then we also say you make a bracha before. So Kriyas HaTorah, where we know there's an obligation to make a bracha before, certainly we should also be making a bracha after. So we have this idea of bookend brachot, but originally, like I was saying, and we see this in the Mishnah, it was really just two readers total who made any brachot. Hapoteach v'hachotem b'Torah mevarech lefaneh ulachareh. The first person to read and the final person to read, they would be the ones who would be reciting a bracha. And there would be one bracha for the entire reading at the beginning and one bracha for the entire reading at the end. Okay, so the bookend structure was really pronounced and it was one to the end. So the idea that a woman might theoretically have been a reader doesn't necessarily give us full information about whether a woman would be able, even in theory, to say these brachot, because at an initial stage of this enactment of Kriyat HaTorah, not everyone was reciting brachot, just reader number one and reader number seven. Okay, and that's also the Ron, when he explains this, he says, yeah, you know why? Because it's one big mitzvah. You have different readers coming in, but it's one big mitzvah. And each reader put together is considered, it's considered like one overall person doing this one big mitzvah. So you need one bracha before and you need one bracha after. Now this changes in the Talmudic times, it changes. The rationale given in the Talmud is interesting. It changes because there's a concern about people coming in and coming out. You ever see someone come late for Torah reading? You ever see someone walk out before it's over? Both these things still happen, I think, and they used to happen too. This is how Rashi understands the Gemara. And the Gemara says that originally it was just the Poteach and the Chotem, the first and the final readers who recited Brachot. But nowadays, each individual reader recites a Bracha before and after Kriyat HaTorah. Okay? And if our concern is for people coming in late or leaving early, what have we accomplished? What we've accomplished is we've made it clear to everybody that a unit of Torah requires bookend brachot. Someone who misses the beginning or misses the end might not realize that there was a bracha before or that another bracha was coming. Now it's going to be crystal clear to everybody who's there that that's what's going on. By the way, there's another way to explain this, that maybe it's talking about the readers. Maybe the reader themselves, maybe all the readers have to hear the brachot and they were worried about a reader coming late. And then a reader would have missed the brachot before reading and that would have been a big problem. And that's why they enacted it. So it could be from the perspective of the readers as well that they enacted that each and every stage of the reading has a bracha before and a bracha after. I want you just even to think about how time allotments work in shul for Kriyas HaTorah. Think how much more streamlined it would be if we did not have a bracha before and after each and every time someone went up to read from Torah. We're talking about a much, much quicker affair. And even if you think about it, sometimes the balance depends on the parsha and its length. Sometimes it feels almost like the balance of the time spent in shul and Kriyas HaTorah is not with the Torah reading, but is with all the stuff going on around it. That's a development. Originally, what's going on, someone going up to the Torah, what that would mean is someone was going to read from the Torah. And originally that someone going to read from the Torah did not necessarily mean that person was making bracha at all. Okay, Chatham Sofer's theory, everyone was always making baruchu. Seder. You can some accept that theory, some don't accept that theory. Then in any case, it's only later that it becomes that anyone who's going up and reading from the Torah is reading before and reading afterwards. And something that's we have to ask ourselves is what type of bracha it is. And there are two real views on that. Rashi says, my time on Varchinan, why do we make a bracha? Mishum davalei mitzvah bifnei atzma. Rashi says, it's like a bracha, birkat a mitzvah. We make brachas over mitzvot. This is a bracha over a mitzvah. Yerushalmi suggests something different. Yerushalmi says, tells a story about a rabbi who hears a Torah reading, and he hears them reading velo mevarchin, and they're not reciting brachos. He says, "An matay etem osin et haTorah karachot karachot. How can you keep making the Torah like it's bald, like it's patchy, like you don't care about it? It doesn't have its frame, its bookends." Okay. In other words, there are two major perspectives on what these brachot are. One perspective is it's a bracha on a mitzvah. A second perspective, it's a bracha that shows honor to the Torah. So aside from the function that the bracha plays as a convocation, there's also a question about the nature of the bracha. And that becomes important to the question of if women can recite these brachot. And before we move forward with that question, one last point. And this is just within the perspective, and the Torah has the view as well, that the bracha is a bracha recited over honor of the Torah. Within that perspective, that doesn't mean that it's just like a free-for-all and you can say it whenever you want. The Torah talks about how this bracha is Mishum Kvod Torah Nitkina. This bracha was enacted in honor of the Torah. In other words, technically it's what we call a Birkat HaShevach, according to the Torah. It's a bracha of praise. It's not a Birkat HaMitzvah, according to the Torah. But it's not just a free-for-all Birkat HaShevach. If you wanted to say it, you could, or something had to happen that would occasion you saying it. This is something that is enacted. It is enacted that we say this praise at this time, just like we have some Birkat HaShevach that are integrated into our tefillah that are enacted that we say at different stages of our tefillah at different times. Okay, has this impact what women could do? There are basically three different approaches to whether a woman could say these brachot. Okay, one approach, each of these approaches finds its way into a Tosfot and Masechet Rosh Hashanah. So let's go through this Tosfot and let's understand the main approaches. Number one is Rav Yitzchak ben Rav Yehuda. This is a teacher of Rashi. He says, now overall the discussion here has to do with women making brachot over voluntary mitzvah performance. Now, what he wants to do is he wants to say, I know that a woman can make a bracha over voluntary mitzvah performance. Why? Because the Gemara says that in theory, a woman could have been a reader from the Torah. And readers from the Torah make brachos. And women aren't obligated in Kriyas HaTorah. And therefore, a woman is making a voluntary, performing a mitzvah voluntarily. And this is an example of her voluntarily reciting the bracha over the voluntary mitzvah performance. That's what he says. He brings a proof that women could say a bracha over any voluntary mitzvah performance. Midam Rinan, from that which we say in Megillah, Hakol al minyan shiva afilu isha afilu katan. Everyone can count toward as a reader, even a woman. Even though a woman is exempt from the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. So he's clearly understanding these brachot as a bracha on a mitzvah. And he's saying, if we understand the bracha as a bracha on a mitzvah, and we understand that a woman could, at least theoretically, be a reader, then we see that a woman could voluntarily recite this bracha, just like a woman could voluntarily recite other brachot over mitzvot. That's possibility number one. Possibility number two is Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, says, not a good proof. Ein zoraya, not a proof. De birkat haTorah lefanel acharei lav mishum Talmud Torah. Because this bracha isn't recited because of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. What he basically wants to say is, this is a bracha of Shevach. So a second theory could be a woman. He doesn't seem to reject the possibility here that a woman, if she were a reader, would recite a bracha. But maybe she can recite a bracha because it's a bracha of praise. And why shouldn't she be able to recite a bracha of praise if she's allowed, if she's allowed to be reading as part of fulfilling this enactment, and the bracha of praise is part of the enactment, so she could, in theory, recite the bracha of praise. Possibility number three, the woman wouldn't say the bracha. Maybe the whole discussion saying a woman could count as one of the readers is assuming that a woman is one of the middle readers, and it's at the stage before everyone said a bracha. And if, in fact, we got to the stage of everyone saying a bracha, then women would not be able to do it. Okay, so he's saying we can't prove anything here because women were only going to be able to read from the middle. So again, we have two main possibilities for how we understand the brachos on Kriyas HaTorah. One is as a bracha over mitzvah. The second is as a bracha of praise. If we understand it as a bracha over a mitzvah, it's possible that a woman reader could recite it as a voluntary recitation of bracha over a mitzvah. If we understand it as a bracha of praise, we could say that a woman who's included, the rabbis or sages who made the enactment make room for a woman to read within the enactment, then she can also make the bracha that's included in the enactment. If, however, we could say at the same time, no, maybe none of this works. And why would this not work? Maybe none of this works because maybe that whole discussion about a woman perhaps being able to read from the Torah was only talking about the middle readings to start with. And those middle readings at a stage before they included making a bracha. So maybe the idea that a woman could, in theory, read from the Torah, maybe it tells us nothing about whether she could have made a bracha later, and maybe she wouldn't really have been able to. Okay? And all of these, because of time, we can't go through all of them, but there are different early halachic authorities that espouse different views on this. Rabbeinu Manoach seems to suggest that, sure, a woman, if she were called up to the Torah, would make the brachos, no problem. The issue with the woman going up to the Torah to read from the Torah is something else. We'll talk about later, Kvod Tzibur, not today. The Meiri seems to suggest that no, a woman can't possibly be a reader in a situation where a bracha has to be recited for every aliyah because a woman is exempt and it's a birkat mitzvah. And perhaps that bracha is also part of discharging an obligation for the community. The Ron takes a different view. He disagrees. So we have a lot of different perspectives on what this can mean in terms of the bracha. Takeaway from what we've got so far. The aliyah, okay, the initial stage of the aliyah is that the reader goes up and the reader recites a bracha before and after. Okay, that's what the Ola LaTorah does. Whether a woman, in theory, could be doing all of those things is a matter of debate. There is a solid halachic argument to be made that a woman in that case could be making and would be making the brachot, perhaps even including baruch. And you could say differently. One of the things that's hard, again, is that we don't have a practical halachic discussion of centuries about what a woman does when she gets called to the Torah. But that doesn't seem, it does not seem that it's ruled out for her to make the brachot, except according to some views, but it's not unanimous. Okay, next step. Let's understand a little bit more about how we got to the aliyah that we have today. They're kind of two different, we have a problem. We saw last week at the end, the Rivash, I think we only saw it maybe in question time. The Rivash says that the reason that we were counting women or minors to start with in Kriyas HaTorah is because sometimes we need more readers. It's hard to get qualified Torah readers. We need them. The Tosefta is also grappling with the situation of not having qualified Torah readers. I mean, this is like a great story of Rabbi Akiva, who they want to call him up to the Torah and he won't go up. And he won't go up because he didn't prepare the laning. That's Rabbi Akiva. So this issue of, have you learned your laning properly? And do we have competent readers that I think a lot of us deal with in our synagogues nowadays, is something that goes way back. The Tosefta talks about one strategy for dealing with the lack of qualified readers. And that's that one person would just do the whole thing. But doing the whole thing means the whole thing. Beit HaKnesset she'en lehem mishi yikra el achad. If you have a shul and there's only one person who can read, omed v'korev yoshev, omed v'korev yoshev, omed v'korev yoshev, afilu shiva pe'amim. He's getting up, he's reading, he's sitting down, up, reading, sitting down. In other words, he's sort of acting, you have one person sort of acting like seven people. That's the first strategy. The second strategy, which is really interesting, the Tosfot talk about, is Mashenu Agin Achshav. Nowadays, what we do, this is medieval Ashkenaz, Shemeseyeh Shalich Tzibor LeKoreh B'Torah. There's a shalich tzibor, a prayer leader, and he helps the person who's reading from the Torah. Kedei shelo levayesh et mi sheino yodea likrot, in order not to embarrass someone who doesn't know how to read. Kinyan shematzino masecha bikurim, shit kinish makrin et akol. We have a precedent for this when it comes to what's called mikra bikurim, that a person who's bringing their bikurim, there's a formula that you say. There are verses from the Torah to say. Not everyone knew how to say them. They repeat them word for word. So imagine someone's going up to the Torah, and it's as though someone's like whispering in their ear what to say, and they're repeating. They're looking at the scroll and they're repeating. Eventually, these strategies sort of converge into what nowadays we call the Baal Koreh, right? Nowadays, we have this situation where it's one person reading the whole thing, and we have other people going up to the Torah as though they're the reader. They're not the ones reading out loud anymore. Okay, now here's where things get tricky. Who makes the bracha? Generally speaking, I mean, we saw in the Mishnah, papotech ve'achotem, it's very clear from the mevarech, it's very clear from the Mishnah, it's clear from the Gemara, that it's the reader from the Torah who makes the bracha. Now, at the point at which you have someone who's reading out loud, and you have someone else coming up, now, originally, let's say with the Tosfot strategy, if someone else is coming up, but they're repeating word for word, and they're still the ones who are saying it out loud, we can understand that person is still the reader and is still making the bracha. They just were getting some help from the side. But nowadays, it's not exactly like what works. That's not what happens. So how does it work? The Rosh suggests a solution. It's not a simple solution. The Rosh suggests like this. He says, look, not everyone knows the trope. We don't have a Kriyas Torah. You can't discharge. There's no communal obligation fulfilled in Kriyas Torah if it's read wrong. And everyone thinks they know. And then it's going to make a whole fight if the person, if this sounds very familiar, right? Very human. Person thinks they know it better than they do. And if you tell them not to lane, you're going to have a whole crisis. So what was the solution? We have the Baal Koreh. Okay. Umikom makom. Gam ha'omed likrot yikra benachat uvdikduk in shaliach tzibur. The person who we now have a new character who's entered the scene, the oleh l'Torah. The person who's just going up to the Torah, but is not actually reading aloud. But the Rosh says that person actually needs to read along with the prayer leader. Shalotei bracha levatala. Because otherwise, he says, it's going to be a bracha levatala. The bracha, from his perspective, has to be said by a reader. What makes or establishes that the Oleh is a reader? The Oleh establishes the status of being a reader by reading quietly from the Torah scroll alongside the Baal Koreh. This, by the way, is common practice. At the same time, it's not perfect. We don't have to go into all the issues, but one essential issue with this is, you know, what actually does it matter that he's reading quietly? The whole thing he's supposed to do is to read out loud. Does it really help him to become the reader if he's reading quietly? This isn't simple. If it's hard for you to follow, it's not your fault. It's really complicated to try to understand how you can have something that is originally enacted as the person who's reading out loud from the Torah is making the bracha, has become someone is making the bracha and someone else is reading out loud from the Torah. So one possibility is, okay, the guy who made the bracha, he's reading quietly. It's not perfect. Another possibility, and this is something suggested by Beit Yosef, is that maybe the person who's coming up to the Torah is like the reader from the halacha of shomea ke'oneh, of hearing being tantamount to responding or to reading. Okay, we have this in different mitzvahs. We talked about last week with Kriyas and Megillah, right? Each and every one of us is obligated in reading the Megillah, and we're considered to be like readers when one person reads and we listen, and it's as though we're tantamount to reading ourselves. So now what the Beit Yosef wants to say is that specifically is working for the guy who's going up to be Oleh L'Torah. The guy who's Oleh L'Torah, when he's listening to the reading, it's as though he's answering. That makes him like a reader, so his bracha worked. This also is not a perfect solution. For example, why is this guy any more of a reader from Shomea Ke'oneh than someone else sitting in the shul? maybe because he sees a scroll, maybe because of the intentionality of the person of the Baal Kol Reh. It's really messy. And this is not something that's resolved. Meaning there are different theories. Rav Moshe Feinstein wanted to suggest that there was a halachic agency involved here, shlichut. It's not really clear how that works either. There are different theories. Each of them has a hole. And it's because this is how we do Kriyas HaTorah really evolved. And it's hard to see exactly how it covers all the bases. That being said, it looks like Shomea Ke'oneh is probably a part of it. Either that or we're going to consider the reader reading along as being tantamount to reading. That's really important when we consider the question of a woman reading from the Torah. Why? Because Shomea Ke'oneh is something that works when someone is when someone's obligated, when someone has an obligation, Shomea Ke'oneh works. When someone doesn't have an obligation, Shomea Ke'oneh doesn't work. It doesn't kick in as a halachic mechanism. According to many opinions, I have to be careful here because there are different ways to understand it. But if you follow those opinions, which tends to be how we understand things, that Shomea Ke'oneh works when someone's obligated, then you have this whole question about, well, can a woman be reading and make Shomea Ke'oneh work for someone else when she's not obligated? For her to read when that wasn't part of the picture, maybe was fine, but maybe now there's a new element of obligation that's required to make the thing work. And you could ask something similar about a woman going up to say the brachot. Maybe we can resolve these issues by a woman who goes up reading quietly along with the Baal Kol Reh. The best way to resolve these issues halachically would really be if there were to be a woman reading from the Torah or going up to the Torah, it should really be a woman who's doing double duty. Okay, if we really want to make sure that we're covering all halachic bases, the best way to, if there were a way to have a woman have an aliyah, the best way for that to be conducted would be for the woman both to recite the brachot, following the viewpoint that a woman can recite the brachot if she's reading, and for the woman to be the reader. It's not necessarily impossible that the aliyah could work otherwise, but it's also not necessarily 100% clear that it could. And there are a lot of voices who say that it can't. Rav Arya Frommer, who was here last week, I don't know if he's here this week, wrote a very extensive article where he argues very, very stridently that it couldn't possibly work another way. Again, we're back to this situation of, you can have a sort of general sense of things, but we're lacking hundreds of years of halachic development because it didn't happen in practice. To know for sure. But the takeaway so far, our practical takeaways about the possibility of a woman reading from a Torah. One is that we talked about which aliyot would be involved, would likely be limited. Certainly not the first ones, probably not the majority of them, possibly only the seventh. And that ideally, so as to get away from questions of how Shomea Ke'oneh works, ideally, either one possibility might be for the woman who's making the brachot to read quietly. And if we follow the Rosh, that could work. But the best possible way to go in this scenario would probably be just for if a woman wants to have an aliyah, that she's reading from the Torah as well. And she's doing both things. I'm just going to say as a parenthetical, it's not a parenthetical, actually. This gets us into our last topic that I want to bring up tonight, which is women's readings. What we've seen from our discussion so far is that we moved from the significance of what someone is doing Kriyas HaTorah, being part of the tzibur and actively listening, and thus fulfilling the mitzvah, or being a reader. In our popular conception or perception of what's significant or what's going on in Kriyas HaTorah, having an aliyah has become a really major factor. Where having an aliyah typically means that someone's going up and they're saying brachot and they're not reading. Now, as we've discussed, it might be that the only way that works is if technically that person is considered to be reading and there are things that person can do to help facilitate it. But even so, I just want to point out, because I think it's really important to recognize that this is really an evolution in what is a meaningful role to play for individuals during Kriyas HaTorah. The idea that the meaningful thing to do is to go up and say the brachot and not to read is based on these centuries of evolution. So we got to the point that we're at now with the Baal Koreh and the person making the brachot being completely different. Again, the person making the brachot might be construed as a reader. That's probably the way we understand why they can make the brachot, either through Shomea Ke'oneh or through it being enough to recite the words quietly. But when people talk about having an aliyah, I think the thing that's important to them is often that they're kicking off the Davar Shebi Kedusha. They're having the moment to take the lead in the community sanctifying God's name in the context of Kriyas HaTorah. So that's wonderful. And that certainly is a very valuable and important thing to do. It's just really important to recognize that that's a role that evolved. Perhaps Baruch Hu came earlier, it's true, and was attached to the reading, but the idea that it would just be Baruch Hu and that the reading would be secondary or maybe not even a part of what's going on, except through kind of a technical halachic mechanism that connects the bracha to the reader, that's new-ish, because we're talking about something that's hundreds of years old, though actually really the way we have it now is really like, it's like a step farther from what was earlier. And it's interesting. I would add even one more note on that level, which is just something that I note is that now in shuls we have a situation where we act like we have a Baal Koreh, but sometimes for the same reasons that the Rosh talks about, we need a Baal Koreh because we're worried that people will think they know and they don't know, and we don't want to embarrass someone, and we don't want to lead to conflict. In synagogues that don't have a professional Baal Koreh, that often happens anyway. We kind of get the ultimate worst of all worlds, you could say, or we could say that we're being wonderfully inclusive. But sometimes you have people who come up to read from the Torah who don't necessarily always know how to read from the Torah well, and no one wants to embarrass them. But the way we set things up now is that they're reading the whole portion, and we're all relying on them. So it's sort of like we still have this setup of the Baal Koreh, but when someone is not truly an absolute expert, It's not actually serving the original purpose of why we're doing this thing that's not so straightforward halachically to start with, how we got into it. Okay, so from there to women's Torah readings, and I think it's a good introduction. I see that our time is short. I'll try to make it brief so that we have time for questions, but it's an important topic. I think it's important before you talk about women's Torah readings to acknowledge the very genuine reasons and very understandable reasons why women might be interested in women's readings. Here I just put up, you can read if you want along, one statement by a women's tefillah group. But basically, many women generally don't have access to Sefer Torah. They don't go near it. It's not, in many shuls, there's not an ability to touch it, to kiss it. That's one thing, proximity to Sefer Torah. Jews love the Sefer Torah, that's natural. It's a good thing to love a Sefer Torah. It's not a toy. But we need to treat it with great respect. But the fact that a woman would want to be close to a Sefer Torah physically, we can understand that she'd want to see into it. Now here's where things get tricky. That she'd want to know how to read from a Sefer Torah also really makes sense. Learning the cantillatory marks can really be revelatory in understanding what the verses mean. It can take your understanding of Torah to another level to understand how trup works properly. It's a beautiful thing. And being able to practice that in a way where you're making the Torah clear to other people is also, it's an exceptional opportunity. Here's where things get tricky. Another reason why women are interested in women's readings is because they want the experience of having an aliyah. And that's a trickier thing. That's a trickier proposition. Why is it a trickier proposition? Well, what we've learned so far is that the halachic definition of Kriyas HaTorah has to take place with minyan. And the aliyah as we know it, where it doesn't entail reading the Torah itself, is this whole evolutionary process that's all within these brachot that were enacted specifically to be said by the reader within the context of fulfilling the enactment of Kriyas HaTorah before minyan. So it's a tricky thing because many, not all, but many, and it's completely understandable. Many women who seek out women's Torah readings, what they're seeking out is the opportunity to have an aliyah. and they can't technically have an aliyah, because the reading that's taking place is technically group Torah study, and not a full-fledged fulfillment of the enactment of Kriyas Torah. Now, it's still women being close to the Torah. They can read the Torah beautifully. There can be a fulfillment of learning Torah from what's done, but it's still not technically considered Kriyas Torah, which means that the brachot that were enacted to be part of Kriyas Torah aren't obligatory here. And that is where these things get really tricky. Now, in fairness, we don't have time to go through all the discussion. There's so much discussion about women's tefillah groups. I want to point out that a lot of the discussion around women's tefillah groups, and in particular, a lot of the objections have been about specifically the Torah services. Women getting together for Kabbalat Shabbat, I'm not saying that no one ever raises questions, but it's much less controversial. And we know that women daven together and have davened together for centuries, that this is saying prayers together as a group of women is a beautiful, praiseworthy thing. The Torah reading is something in particular that raised concerns. So for example, one question has to do with moving the Torah, taking the Torah out specifically for this purpose. We don't just move the Torah around for fun, but this isn't just fun. So really that winds up getting into sort of like a hashkafic question about, well, how important are these readings? Let's say a Chabad house might take out a Sefer Torah to show the kids in town what a Torah looks like, or a school might take a Sefer Torah out to show it to children. Are women's desire to be close to the Torah and learn Torah from looking into the Torah any different from that? So that's a real discussion, and you can argue both sides. Another question has to do with creating rituals or emulating rituals for the purpose of spiritual gratification. There's Talmudic precedent for doing that kind of thing. We know that, for example, the korbanot were passed around to women to, as it were, lean on them, but they didn't really lean on them because they weren't fully obligated, and they weren't obligated in the mitzvah of leaning on a sacrifice. That was permitted in Beit HaMikdash. It's a pretty big deal. And that was permitted even though there might have been a violation of a rabbinic, of appearing to violate a rabbinic law of appearing to do something with sacred animals that is not strictly for the purpose of the temple service. That kind of logic apply here. And you could say that it would. A counter argument might be, well, and this is Rav Schachter, Rav Schachter of YU's counter argument is, well, that was specifically because there was no other way for them to lean on the sacrifice. In the context of Kriyas Torah, a woman who wants to fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyas Torah just has to go to shul. It's not that she has no option to fulfill it without having her own service. There's a lot of questions and there's a lot of hesitancy. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein writes about understanding the feelings of people who want this, but he's worried about how it's going to affect halacha. There's a lot of questions in the background. Like if we're talking about the technical question about what's going on with the aliyah, so I found this source to be particularly important. And this is a Shari Ephraim. And he's an Achron, and he's talking about how, let's say you have a place where you have a community where they have a Sefer Torah and they don't have a minyan. Rural community. There are a number of families. Let's say there's 6-7 families, and they have 8 men on a Shabbos. They don't have 10 men every Shabbos. What do they do when it comes time for Torah reading? He says, Yishuvim she'en sham minyan, v'rutzim likrot ha-sidra b'torah b'knufiya shelahem. A yishuv that doesn't have a minyan and they want to read the Torah together as a group, below bracha klal rishaim, if they want to do it without any bracha at all, those men are permitted to do it for the community. V'gam yacholim lomar haftara b'nviim below bracha, and they can say the haftara without a bracha. Klal, without a bracha at all. V'en lem likrot olim l'torah, rak echad yikra kol ha-sidra, and they shouldn't even have different people, as it were, coming up to the Torah like olim. Rather, one person should read the whole thing, mitoch ha-sefer, v'shar yishma'u. They're trying to make it distinct from create a Torah is. So on the one hand, they can have it set up, close to the Torah and learn from it. And on the other hand, not mistake it for Kriyas Torah. Some suggestions that have been made for how to make women's group Torah study in women's tefillah groups resemble Kriyas Torah are really tricky. And again, they're balancing this tension And the tension is that on the one hand, halachically, it can't really be an aliyah in a full-fledged sense. And on the other hand, part of the reason why women are interested in doing this is to have the experience of an aliyah. And that experience, by the way, can be profound. There are women who will say that this was one of the spiritual highs of their lives, was having an aliyah in a women's Torah service. And this is a very difficult tension to navigate, that women going to these services want it to be as close as possible to the aliyah experience. And at the same time, it's not an aliyah. So what do you do? So one suggestion, which has been credited variously to Rav Avi Weiss and to Rav Saul Berman, is that a woman wouldn't say Birkos HaTorah in the morning. She wouldn't say Birkos HaTorah in the morning. And she would have in mind when she says Ava Rabba not to be Yotzei Birkos HaTorah. And that way, she could say Asher Bach, the Bracha of Asher Bachar Banu before the Torah reading. This is not something that's really been widely embraced. It hasn't been widely embraced because it's difficult. It's difficult to tell someone not to make the bracha they're supposed to recite and to make another bracha not having the kavana that one usually has for it, so that they can make the bracha later in a way that approximates a ritual. It's just a difficult thing. Is it technically prohibited? Different people will give you different answers. There are plenty of people who will say it is prohibited. But even so, as a policy, is it a good policy? It's tricky. Now, I spoke with the shul rabbi who has this in his shul, and he said when it got started, it actually seemed to him to be a positive thing because a lot of the women who were saying Birkos HaTorah in this way in the women's tefillah group were women who otherwise weren't saying Birkos HaTorah in the morning at all. So this was a win. It wasn't that they were omitting something they usually said. It was that they were saying something that they should be saying that ordinarily they weren't. Over time, this rabbi came to think that it wasn't so helpful because these women still weren't saying it every morning. They were only saying it in this context. This is a response by Rav Baruch Givi. It was written for a book about mitzvah, where he talks about how Pashut Shikriyat HaTorah Tzichasara. An official Kriyas HaTorah needs 10 men. V'lachin gam b'nochachut nashim b'lvad yishar kriya b'torah. It's not considered Kriyas HaTorah officially in a women's tefillah group. Sherei zeh min ha'dvarim shebekdusha tzrichim asara. It's davar shebekdusha. Nagu b'miktzat mekomot shenashim mitkansot l'kriya b'torah b'lo brachot. In some places, women get together and they read from a Torah without brachot. U'bazeh af shel aniyat dati lo mumlatz lasot kem mipnei ha'pritzut shavu l'davar ligrom mikol makom em bazeh ikuv mitzad halacha. He says, look, I'm not thrilled about that, but I think it's mutter. Okay, he says, I think it's mutter for women to get together over a Torah scroll with the elite, with taking turns, just not saying a bracha. U'aniyat dati en laf sher l'nashim l'varech lifnei ha'kriya. In my opinion, you shouldn't have women making a bracha before the kriya. Af shel lo birchu birkat ha'torah shem bracho b'kol yom, even if they didn't say birchos ha'torah. Lest they come to think that it's just an aliyah. And how much more so you can't say the bracha after. Now this is typical of a more liberal response to these issues. Now here's what gets even trickier. I was looking online to try to understand what's going on with women's field groups now. Now, overall, and we're going to talk about partnership with Yanim Bezrat Hashem in future installments of the series. Overall, these groups have actually been somewhat losing steam, as a lot of people who previously would have been interested in women's field groups have migrated to partnership with Yanim. But within these groups, one of the things that's tricky is what's the practice. Now, Jofa did a survey and put out a document talking about what the practice is. And they got to 23 women's tefillah groups, which is a pretty big number. I don't think there's a huge amount more of active women's tefillah groups in America. They got 23 to answer them. I don't know exactly how many there are, but they got 23 to answer them. And you have things like 15 said that their service is called a Kriyat HaTorah, not a Limud Torah. And another two said that they use either term. This is an interesting idea. One group has the service with everyone says Birchas HaTorah together. In all but two of the group, a woman recites something before the reading. It could be a pasuk. You can always say a pasuk. But often the pasuk that's chosen is one that deliberately sounds like a bracha, which is the well complicated again. In many groups, but not all, the woman recites a closing blessing or passage as well. The standard aliyot without baruch are recited by women called to the Torah in 10 groups. Oh, you just look at that. So in 10 of these groups, women just say the bracha. And in only one of these groups are women actually actively reminded not to say Birchas HaTorah in the morning service, if that's what they're doing. So what I'm trying to say is that one of the things that, and then just to further make things complicated, in some places, the blessing, Baruch Atah Hashem Lamdeni Chukecha, that's the most popular for alternative aliyot where bracha isn't said. But even here, what did they call it? This is a pasuk, but what did she call it? The blessing, Baruch Atah Hashem Lamdeni Chukecha. The woman is saying the pasuk, but she thinks it's a blessing. And the point is, so it sounds like a blessing. This is really, really tricky. It's just very tricky. It's tricky because in practice, it would seem that groups aren't being as careful as they might be in terms of defining what they're doing and explaining the halachot behind it on a regular basis. And the issue of brachot seems to be that their brachot said very freely. And where the brachot are not said, what's said instead is said in a way to feel like a bracha or to sound like a bracha, to the point that it gets described often as a bracha. It's hard. Because sometimes we talk about things in, you know, what might they be or how might they work out or how it could be. And in practice, it doesn't seem necessarily that these groups are being held with complete care about these issues. Now, of course, in some places, the rabbi or the local rabbi has given a ruling that brachot can be said. But generally speaking, that ruling is contingent on something like if you didn't say Birchas HaTorah in the morning. And that, according to the survey, isn't being explained. So I'm not saying that this is necessarily the case in all of these groups. What I am saying is that the care and attention to halachic detail that we would want to take place in these groups is not always happening, and that's obviously really that's a very important factor. So, you know, because sometimes some of the biggest objections to these groups was, well, it's going to be a slippery slope, and women are going to be reciting the brachot freely, and they're not going to know any difference between what they're doing and the official Kriyas HaTorah. And those were things said as slippery slopes. And what's hard, so I, you know, of course I can't, I don't think Jofa was deliberately doing anything. I think they're being honest about the survey results. It doesn't seem in practice like these distinctions are being very carefully maintained in many of these groups. And when you talk to women about the groups and what they want, they'll talk about, I'm getting an aliyah. I had an aliyah. And that's the point. And it's also the problem. Now, if these groups could be, why could it be important for these groups to work? Again, the motivations behind them is great. The motivation is for women to have an experience of being close to Sefer Torah and to know how to read from a Torah, at least some women. And the desire for a woman to have the experience of an aliyah is very understandable. And it's just hard to see how it happens in practice. And yet, what we're going to see next time is that we're going to see that there's this similar controversy around partnership minyanim. And at that point, you say, well, wait a minute, what options are we giving women? What are we saying? On the one hand, we're saying that there's these challenges that are not necessarily being met to the satisfaction of halachic authorities of women's tefillah groups, even some of the more liberal authorities, and on the other hand, we're going to see a lot of debate and controversy around partnership minyanim, and it's sort of like, well, I can't do the one that's in shul, or I can, but you don't think I should go to that shul, and you don't like the women's tefillah groups, and so, you know, where am I supposed to go with this? Kind of a conundrum. And I don't have a great resolution to that, but I wonder if, I'm saying it's a hypothetical, I've often wondered if if, as opposed to the very strong negative reaction that women's tefillah groups initially received, if the reaction had been more measured and there had been more kind of active rabbinic participation in how they were conducted, and more rabbinic availability in a positive way to help them be conducted in accordance with the dictates of halacha, at least according to some opinions. I wonder if the situation could be different from what it is. And it's just a very tricky thing. But yeah, fundamentally, we've learned about the Aliyah, and the Aliyah is what we did today. We learned about the Aliyah. The Aliyah kind of took on a life of its own. It's kind of funny that for a lot of people, for a lot of men in Shul already, the Aliyah, or the center focus of what you can do in Kriyas HaTorah, is reciting the brachos. And now we have a situation where women who want to emulate the Kriyas HaTorah experience, or different aspects or leadership aspects of the Kriyas HaTorah experience on their own, and it's understandable, are particularly interested specifically in an Aliyah. And where the Kriya, reading from the Torah, where it's not officially Kriyas HaTorah, but you're still actually reading from the Torah in the sense of learning together, that definitely happens and can happen, or at least according to some opinions, it can happen. I should be careful because there are different opinions about this. But the Aliyah aspect is actually much harder when you're outside of the context of the official enactment of Kriyas HaTorah. Okay, Tov, I'm sorry I took so much time. I can stay around for questions. Anyone who wants to stay is welcome to stay, but I'm sorry that we've gone so over. Okay, Rav Jay.
Yes. I will listen. The way you the tension, I hear it in you, the difficulty of the issue. And I think, and I don't think as a man I can fully understand it, someone who's could lay, I think only really a woman can understand it. And I hear it, it's a beautiful, what I don't know what the word is to describe, but it's we're struggling with the issue. Like I said, the end of Dr. Lakshin's class, if anybody would have told you we'd be here 50 years ago or even 30 years ago, 50 years ago, a woman couldn't study Talmud. Like, it was almost impossible. Yoatzot was like, who even know what that meant? And, it's we're a woman, Talmidei Chachamot. And like you say, that's what we said. And yesterday, that Efrat, where you live, appointed a shul, appointed a woman to be their manigah. It's like unbelievable. So what will be? And, it would have been 50 years ago, could have had this. How can women learn Talmud? It's against the Rambam. It's tiflut, it's against the mission of Sota. You could have quoted 1,000 reasons why it's forbidden for a woman to learn Gemara. So sometimes what we think is forbidden today might not be later. Although I will, and then I'll get to the questions. I'm not sure your last point, if they had done with rabbis. I really need, you need people who really, were the forerunners in the 70s. But I think in Rabbi Riskin's shul, like Lincoln Square, which is where, a lot of this got started, there was rabbinic leadership, and Rav Gorin was involved in issuing, I think Rav Gorin did allow, I don't think you mentioned Rav Gorin, but I think he did allow women to actually have aliyot. He was sort of, I don't know if you want to call him an outlier, but he did allow it. And I do think they did. I don't think the issue was that the people, the rabbis who were upset they weren't following rabbinic opinion. I don't think the people against didn't accept those rabbis who said it was allowed. I think it's a more fundamental problem.
What I'm trying to say is that if it had been if it had been something that the community was working on, as opposed, you had certain rabbinic figures who were involved and supportive. You had a very strong, you had like the Queen's Vada Rabbanim issuing a psak that's absolutely usur and in a very strong way. The YU rabbis, 1985, issuing a psak that is completely usur and terrible and a lot of different ways. And those psakim, of course, you can respect them and they're valid psakim. And at the same time, I just wonder if, I can't help wondering if these kind of more lowercase c conservative or Rabbanim had been involved in helping to shape what women's tefillah experiences would be, kind of honoring that as a space, which, by the way, in medieval times, there were some communities where women had their own shuls, and they weren't saying Devar Shebekedusha. In a lot of medieval communities, the mechitza was such you didn't hear the shul at all. And there was a woman who had the official role of leading the other women in prayer. I mean, the idea that women would get together to pray is something that goes way back. The Torah aspect of this in particular, I think, is something that set over the edge, as did, of course, the background of feminism and all kinds of concerns. And those are, you know, those are, it's legitimate that those were concerns, and or they are concerns. But I just can't help wondering if there had been a kind of collaborative supportive process in trying to develop what could a prayer gathering of women look like aside from just Tehillim, right? Not to wrap Tehillim. Tehillim are beautiful, but what could a prayer gathering of women look like in a way that could be, you know, receive maximal support? And how can we help guide women to shape that? And in what ways, you know? So I guess I'm a dreamer. I'm just saying that what I see when I look at that Jofa document, it's a little painful for me. And I think the reason why it's painful is because it's clear that the kinds of stuff that we were learning today, like it's not stuff that people have necessarily had the opportunity to learn, especially women participating in these groups necessarily, or it's something that was taught once when the group began, and then there wasn't follow up and it sort of left on its own. And I think it's healthy for women to be able to have ritual spaces in certain contexts. And I think it's healthy if those spaces are not kind of treated as, it's healthy if those spaces are in dialogue with the community and in connection with it. And that's the kind of thing that can help them be maximally, both maximally fulfilling and maximally, I guess, halachic. Let's say if someone, you know, is having a women's tefillah group. So, you know, if when students in the past have asked me for guidance on it, you know, one of the things I'll say to them is also you have to recognize not all these groups are the same, and you have to do research in advance and understand what's being done in the group and how, because they're not all the same. And I think women who have the women who might be here who might have had that experience might have experienced that different groups, you might assume that something works a certain way because in your women's tefillah group this is how it works, and you go to another group and it's not necessarily that way. So, shuls are very varied too. Look, it's hard. Sorry, I'm going on and on.
It's very nice and beautiful. I think the real world is much more complex, as you know. And there are lots of whatever. Well, let's get to some of the questions that the people put in the chat box. Okay, let me go back to the beginning. There are a whole bunch. We'll try to do this relatively quickly. And if you're busy now, whatever, you can listen. We'll have the recording up. Usually they're up, you know, within a day. Okay, sometimes early. Coming early, yeah. Somebody asking about, I guess you were alluding to that, can be a man being yotze from a woman if he only hears the woman making the aliyah. If it's a public reading, how would he be yotze kriyat haTorah?
Mm-hmm. So, yes. I mean, if you follow the viewpoint that... According to the understanding that the Rashi, the simple understanding of the Gemara, that the brachas before and after each aliyah are there so that everyone knows there's a bracha before and after, they're not there to help an individual be yotzei a bracha. They're there so that everyone knows there's a bracha before and after. So in theory, that's something that could be accomplished by a woman doing it. That being said, there's an opinion in the Ravan. He does view it as the person making the bracha is being yotzei each individual's obligation in the bracha. That's not usually how the bracha obligation is understood. It's understood usually as it's an obligation on the reader, and it's fulfilling a requirement of Kriyas HaTorah.
Okay, Judy just pointed out, we did this once at the Minyan I was having backyard. They taka did do just the first aliyah and the last aliyah, the first half and the last half, and the backyard Minyanim in COVID. I love how quickly the Kriyas HaTorah was on those weeks. And even now, they're no mishabereks. It's a pleasure. That's, I agree, to make a Minyan a lot quicker, that's a good area to cut out. Okay. David Eisen sort of is suggesting why we don't say the second bracha, Birkat HaTorah, for the aliyah, you know, the Asher Natan it's not the same, the Birkat HaTorah and the bracha of the aliyah, suggesting that there is no end to Talmud Torah, but there is an end to Kriyas HaTorah.
Yeah,
Interesting idea. Okay. All right. The source link, yes, please God, there's a quirk on our website. They will go up on the website soon. Last week's sources are there. They are on the, you know, Derechecha website, but we'll have it on the website next to the audio and the video. Okay. Can Allah appoint a woman to be the Shaliach for the purpose of reading the Torah, according to
Rav Moshe? If you go by Rav Feinstein's opinion, answer is, I don't know, because it's really hard to understand what he means by shlichus in what he writes. It's not fully worked out. It's not widely understood as being how it works with the shlichus. So it's hard to say. I mean, a man in general can appoint a woman to be a shaliach, but exactly, I honestly don't fully understand what he's saying there. So I can't even tell you.
A whole discussion on the mechitza, what people do with the mechitza middle. I will say, maybe I'll get into trouble here, but halachically speaking, of course, and I purely halachically speaking, a mechitza, of course, is only required for amida. You don't really need a mechitza for Kriyas HaTorah. Halachically, I'm not on communal and all the minhagim. So I don't think the mechitza issue, it's sort of people ask where on the koalisha issue that you didn't even raise. You know, what it's
we're assumed, not there yet.
We'll get there. A lot of people assume it's not it, but in it's yes. People put the mechitza down the middle, all kinds of solutions, but I don't know that's the issue of a mechitza is not the real issue. That's sort of a side issue, as I understand it. Trump, yeah, we had a 5-part series, Rabbi Weider from YU, who's the best Balkori in the world, most like expert Balkori in the world. We did a 5-part session, how Trump as Parshanut, and as I told him, the lesson I learned from his shirm is I'm never laning again in public. You gotta, the detail and the beauty of the pshat and the trap of very little thing. Yes, that's true. Woman to Tehillah group at Sharei, that's when in Newton, right? Said the bracha before and after the reading, no barchu. I didn't read it carefully enough. Is that true? Right? Yeah, okay. Kabbalah Shabbos, yes, of course, is a recent concept, 16th century, so it's a little bit easier, that issue. I don't think I mentioned last week, there was a rabbi who mentioned to me, I won't mention his name, but he, in his shul, they used to have kids do Kabbalah Shabbos. They have that a lot of places in Israel. They want to train the kids because it's not part of the minyan, and the chazan sometimes in the middle of the shul. And so they get an 11-year-old kid to daven until barchu. And the woman in the shul complained, it's not right that have a kid and not the woman to allow it. If you're going to allow the kids, you should allow the woman. So we stopped allowing, you know, kids to do it. You can argue with like his solution, but that was an interesting point. But yes, Kabbalah Shabbos is not part of a minyan.
We're not going to talk in the context of these shiurim. We're not talking about partnership minyan per se. There's a lot of different things that partnership minyanim do. There are also a lot of different partnership minyanim that do a lot of different things. That's a huge topic. There are a lot of different things. I actually prefer, we're talking here about Kriyas HaTorah, and we're going to talk about partnership minyanim with respect to Kriyas HaTorah. And I actually think that's the right way to look at issues related to partnership minyanim, because there's so much variation from group to group. I think the best thing is really to look practice by practice and understand what they're doing and what the discussion is. So,
okay, Zoe, I'm not sure. You also said be absent when Kriyas Shema said during, you know, Shachrit, which is another reason some poskim don't.
Well, they want to suggest that their suggestion is that you have kavana not to be yotzei with.
Rabba,
but then it said, but you're really supposed to be saying Berachas HaTorah before you say a pasuk. It's just not simple. It's not simple.
Right. Right. That was the objection that our posek made as to why women can't say the brachot at Arta Tefillah service, which is at Harvard Hillel.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Rabbi Weiss and Rabbi Berman, okay, their solution for the bracha following the aliyah.
What they say about the bracha following the aliyah, or at least what Rav Weiss quotes, I think he quotes it maybe in the name of Rav Berman, there's a Masechet Sofrim that suggests that someone who's learning on their own can make the bracha after the learning on their own. The issue is that the psak is not that way. Someone who learns on their own from a Torah scroll does not recite the bracha following Kriyas HaTorah. So the fact that Masechet Sofrim said it is really interesting. Take from that precedent that we can say the bracha when it's not actually, we don't actually paskin following what it says is difficult. It's difficult.
Zoe, I assume you're talking about Lamdeini Chukek is what they do at Harvard Hillel. Is that what they actually do?
That's what we actually do. I'm the one that chose the blessing. I'm the one that chose what we say
before. It's not a blessing. Lamdeini Chukecha is a pasuk.
Right.
It's a pasuk. It's not a bracha. And the reason that people want to say it is because it sounds like a bracha. And that there's a way in which that's a great advantage, because it gives that sense, it gives that aliyah sense without stepping over into, you know, bracha levatala. And there's the disadvantage, which it obfuscates that this is, you know, it's not aliyah. We're back to that tension, right? The woman getting the aliyah wants to feel like it's an aliyah.
Right.
Halacha.
I mean, that's been a point of great tension with our services. So.
Yeah. And also for a lot of women, that it's not an, it, for some women, it's too much. And for some women, it's not enough. And, you know, it's
always the way it goes.
it's a real tension.
Fortunately for our post-sec, it's okay, which is also another factor.
Right. Look, technically, you can say Baruch Atah Hashem Lamdeni Chukecha with Shem Hashem when you want, because it's a pasuk.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
The question is, what does it mean to say it in different contexts, and what impression are you doing, and what are you creating?
Right. Make it look like bracha. When it isn't bracha, yeah, all the issues. Okay. Tough, as you say. I'm pointing out that the idea of how the practice that we give a blind person an aliyah might play into this whole thing. Because in practice, you know.
Absolutely on point, 100%. It's a central discussion. Though what's interesting is, like, the original rulings to allow a blind person to get an aliyah were that the blind person was repeating word for someone who was saying it quietly, not just that a blind person was up there. That also seems to have evolved. But the fact that we allow a blind person to say an aliyah, at the same time, we also still say that a preference lechachila is like the rosh, that someone who goes up for an aliyah should be reading it if they have eyesight and they're able to read. So it helps us. It was very relevant in Corona, where people were getting aliyot who were not necessarily next to Kriyas HaTorah in some communities, next to the Torah scroll in some communities. So that's important. Basically, we have kind of a conundrum with these halachos. This is what I'm saying. Like, I said in the shiur, when I started seeing, you know, like when you see Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach say, I don't understand how this, or I don't have a full explanation for how this works, you feel a little better that you're not fully resolved at how it works. I mean, it's really very complicated to understand how all the psakim fit together to have the Baal Korah work the way it does now. So there are theories, but it's not like there's one answer and it's perfect and it resolves everything. So the blind man is part of the complications of the issue.
And listen, basically there were three solutions or three approaches, as I understood it. Our backyard minion where I daven, people get aliyah, they're 50 feet away. And when they call me aliyah, I'm not even in the same backyard as where the Sefer Torah is. I'm in a separate backyard. I'm like 50 feet away from the Baal Korah, but they call me up for aliyah. When they first did, I was a little uncomfortable. Because, you know, but now I've been down there for so long, and that's such the minhag. That's when, like, then there's the minhag, you know, I mentioned one person reads at the beginning, one aliyah at the beginning, like half at the beginning, half at the end. That's not so common, I don't think. And then a lot of shuls, you know, the Baal Korah gets all seven aliyahs, like seven times. It's an aliyah, it seems. Anyways, whatever. These, as you say, all difficult issues. Risa is hoping that maybe the Mashiach will come and there can still be constructive rabbinic leadership. And
there is constructive. I didn't mean to say there's no constructive rabbinic leadership. It's just, I guess, like, what, you know, it just, this was something that met with a lot of objections very early, the women's field groups. A lot of very, very strong, strenuous objections. And it meant that often they developed without dialogue. So, you know, what Zoe, for example, is describing, that they're in dialogue, they have a post-sec that they're working with. That's a very different experience than some groups that are sort of more independent. And there are a lot of differences.
Okay. David Eisen, I didn't know that Adam Furziger is a descendant, I didn't know, called the Firdziger. I don't know, maybe that was the word. Firdziger, the woman who would announce where they are in the duffing. Okay, very nice.
Should be a Firdzigerin or something? I don't know.
A change of community because of changes in post-sec. Again, I'm not exactly sure. Changes, obviously, listen, it's very important. The post-sec and the community can work together.
Another thing that I think is, you know, that's one of the things that was it's actually so interesting about that JOFA document. And I think it's interesting here in general is, like, nowadays Rav Ezra Schwartz actually wrote something interesting about this in Lehrhaus recently, which has to do with centralization. So now with the internet and everything else, So on the one hand, there's a way in which a posek has a sense of his community, generally speaking, and can connect to it. And sometimes that's going to be very important in determining what halachic path the community should follow within the range of what's halachically acceptable. And then at the same time, right now we're in an age with anything that happens in one community is known everywhere else instantly.
And that's bad.
Well, it's not necessarily bad. It can be great also, but it makes it harder for the, thanks for the link.
There's no Maradatra anymore. There's no such thing as a Maradatra anymore.
Well, it just makes it harder when one of the big discussions, and it's going to come up again when we talk about partnership minyanim, one of the big debates about it has to do with, well, what rank posek do you have to be to say something like this is okay? So with women's tefillah groups, that's a good question as well. Though right now they seem like very mild compared sometimes in some ways compared to partnership minyanim to in terms of controversy, right? They're not the hot topic the same way. But this is a question of like what level posek do you have to be to say something is all right? And it's a good question, of course. And then you know one of the responses has been, well, someone who's local, again, they have their ear to the ground, they know what's needed, et cetera, et cetera. But that whole dynamic, I think, changes now, where what's local doesn't stay local, and that's a real problem. So it can work to communities. It can work to everyone's advantage when you find out sometimes about possibilities that you might never have known about otherwise, and it can work to everybody's. It can work to disadvantage as it becomes much more difficult for a differentiated psak to be given somewhere because there's an understanding that people apply, and I know this from working on Hilchot Nida, in particular on the internet, and also women getting in touch with me. It's rampant. I had a call recently from someone who was said someone was permitted such and such during Corona. Can I do it now? I'm having a tough time with my husband. I don't want to go into the details of the question, but it was sort of like it was a fascinating thing because for the woman who was asking me. The whole aspect of context dropped out. You know, the fact that something might be affected by that particular person's community or situation and some of the exigencies of COVID weren't what stayed with the woman who came to me. What stayed with the woman who came to me was, bottom line, something was permitted to this woman, which I'm not even sure that she got that completely accurate. Why not me? And, you know, So even a local posek is no longer really local. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Creates more uniformity. It makes innovation much, much harder in any area, in any direction. Yeah. Okay, that's for another discussion. Okay, I think that pretty much got all the questions covered pretty much. So we want to thank you and always for your sensitivity to the topic, as I always say, and the fairness and the reading of the sources removed from all the harshness of this discussion that sometimes goes on. So that's always a pleasure. Thank you. We look forward to next week and continuing. And okay, this evening, Moshe Sokolov, Dr. Sokolov, on the Haftorah of the Week. I invite you to come. That's 8 p.m. this evening. Tomorrow morning, Shuli Mishkan, 11 a.m. for our always fascinating series. And now we're doing the Modern State of Israel. And then tomorrow night, Rebecca Winter was also fascinating. We'll be young, very neuro PhD or neuroscience, but Talmida Chachama. Talmidei Chachamah, we're giving the Parsha Shir tomorrow night, and Friday morning I'll be giving the Pirkei Avot Shir at 9:30 a.m. So we look forward to learning with you and then continuing all the Shirim next week. Okay, everybody, be well. We look forward to your comments or all suggestions. We'll try to get it. I think somebody wrote that the sources now are up on our website. I'd be very happy to hear. I'm glad that means that the glitch we had is fixed. That's a good thing. And we always look forward to your ideas and suggestions, and we appreciate it. And Lori, of course, we appreciate all the hard work and the patience and taking all the questions. So thank you very much, and we'll see you all soon. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Good night.
My love. Yes.